to the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Thanks to David Deering for filling in last night. Joey Molinaro is running things tonight. And the star of the show is here, Donald Davidson. Hello, Donald.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I'm great. Let's get right into it tonight and see how many we can visit with this evening at 317-239-1070. You can send an email, Kevin at 1070thefan.com, and we'll do a couple of email-only shows, at least on race week, if not before. Twitter is not really the preferred method because they're going to get lost in the shuffle. If you tweet me something and I find it is so interesting, I must pass it along. I might, but I won't promise that that will happen. So email, there's an easier way to archive it, and I can come back to it later when we're really getting into email questions. Oh, and also, by the way, special request. I had a few tweets last night concerned about our friend Dave from Marion because he hasn't called in. And my thought would be, well, he probably got a busy signal. But I have good news to report on Dave from Marion, right, Donald?
I saw Dave at the Winchester event. I don't remember what the date was, but it was, what, 2-3 weeks ago? And so I saw Dave and spent a little time with him.
So I'm going to give a special dispensation for Dave. Are you in tomorrow night, Joey?
I am.
Okay. At 7:50, you know, normally we don't answer the phone until at least 7:55. At 7:50, if Dave wants to call in, Joey will take his call and put Dave on hold as a special long-time contributor to the program.
He probably ran out of questions is what happened.
I know that did not happen.
I think we did every driver in the 500.
No, there are 700 and how many? 700?
763.
Yeah, so there's still several left.
Okay.
Several left. So we look forward to that tomorrow night on the show or next week if Dave has prior arrangements and engagements for tomorrow night. This time we start in Fort Worth, Texas. Ken is with us. Hi, Ken. You're on the Talk of the Gasoline Alley.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for taking my call. How are you gentlemen doing tonight?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, you made me laugh there. There's no way Dave has run out of questions.
Yeah.
It's not possible. I've been listening for a month to old archives. I mean, and you know, every night you hear Dave, I've been listening. Every episode this week, I've already listened to at least 5 times at work. So, I live in Fort Worth, and I have a little antique mall very close to me. And a few months ago, I found a nice little piece from one of our local drivers. It's an old racing jacket that apparently was Jim McElreath, and I was just wondering if you could profile him tonight for us.
Yeah, so in fact, he lives very close to you. He lives in Arlington. And which is where the baseball park is, and Jim started racing in 1945, and which is right after the war, and he came up to the Midwest in 1960 to seek his fortune, and started running IMCA, and a young fellow by the name of Johnny Rutherford came with him, and they showed up right before the 500 in 1960. And they slept underneath a park. Underneath a park bench at Leonard Park, which is just a little bit west of the racetrack. And then they went over to watch the race up in the grandstands up in Turn 3. Anyway, Jim McElreath was hooked up with Diz Wilson. I don't know if that happened right away, but he did run IMCA. And in 1961, he won the Little 500 at Anderson. And I know for some people, when you say Little 500, you have to distinguish. Are you talking about the bicycle race, the IU thing, or are you talking about the race at Anderson? But anyway, Jim McElreath won that in 1961. And in those days, that was definitely a sign of the future because a lot of drivers would do well in the Little 500 and then be in the Indianapolis 500 the next year. And that was true for Jim McElreath. And could take a while, so we better shorten it up and throw in some of my favorite car names. Like, for instance, in 1962, the Schultz Fueling Equipment Company Special, owned by Ollie Prather, and he ended up sixth. Now he started seventh, and there might even be a little bit of an anecdote here, because he started seventh and then immediately started passing cars, and he passed A.J. Foyt to get to third place, and then he passed Roger Ward, And Rogers said, and he went on to win that race, and he said, I knew we were down on power, but he said, he said Foyt got by him, but then he said Jimmy McAreath got by him. So I may have the order slightly wrong on when McAreath passed Foyt and when he passed Ward, but he did get up to second. And at 20 laps, 50 miles, he was running second. And then supposedly it was lengthy pit stops. I know that I either read or heard people discussing that perhaps the pit crew did not give McAreath the finish that he really deserved, but he did finish sixth and won the Rookie of the Year award. The following year, driving for Bill Forbes, he had another sixth, and he was also second at 50 miles. So so for his first two starts, he was running second at the 50-mile mark. 64, he drove for Granatelli, one of the STP Novi's, a rear-drive version, did not finish. And then in 65, he drove for John Zink, drove a rear-engine car, a Brabham, that in 65, I think it was one of the 1964 Jack Brabham cars. Eventually, Denny Moore built a copy, which McAreath ran later. Anyway, let's see. He did not finish in 65. In 66, he got third, and that was behind Graham Hill and Jim Clark. And I'll just hurry through the thing here because I've got a couple of anecdotes I'd like to tell about him. The next good finish he would have had was 1970, and he actually got bumped that year. He came with Myron Caves, qualified and got bumped. And then on the last day, he qualified a fourth A.J. Foyt car. And that deal came together on Saturday evening. And in fact, after qualifications were over on Saturday, I happened to go into, well, I would say it was the men's room. It was the only, I mean, it was men only in those days. Anyway, I went into the restroom, and here was Jim McAreath and Foyt in discussion, evidently wrapping up the deal that would put McAreath in the car the following day. Wow. So I actually heard that. So
you never know.
No, you never know. I mean, it's very, very different now, and we hear all these putting deals together and millions of dollars and everything. That one sounded to me like it was locked up in the restroom in the garage area. But anyway, so McAreath came out the following day, and he started 33rd. I don't think he was the 33rd fastest qualifier, but he did start 33rd. Because now I hadn't thought about this for a while. I think he was the only qualifier on the last day. And we were still doing four-day qualifying, and you lined up according to the day on which you qualified. And I think he was the only successful qualifier on the last day, so he started 33rd. And went on to finish 5th. And then other notable finishes was 6th in 74. I am jumping around here a little bit. And then I think that would be the last time. His final start was 1980. He was trying as late as 1983 or 4, but the last start was 1980. I'll have to count up the number of starts. I think it was 15. And he won at other races. I think he... Did he win 5 championship races? I know he won at... golly, I'm going to have to brush up on this stuff. He won at Langhorne, the first race that was paved in June of 65, ended up being a 125-mile race. No, that was the second one. The first one was a 100-miler, was it? Anyway, he won at Lang. There was 2 races at Langhorne in 65, and McAreath won one of those. He also won at Phoenix, and then in 1970 he won the inaugural Ontario 500, which was probably his biggest victory. And the back and forth, there was a crazy finish with 4 different leaders in the last 13 laps, it would be. And he and Art Pollard were back and forth a couple of times, but Jim McAreath came out as the winner of the first Ontario 500. And a man of few words, I got a couple of personal stories about him, but I don't know if the people would rather hear about his activities on the track. I think when you're talking about who were the drivers that might have won, and there are the names that come up obviously, but I think if you go down and start looking like maybe 10 or 12, I'm not too sure that Jim McAreath isn't one of the ones that you would consider that was a possible Indianapolis 500 winner. I mean, he didn't he didn't start on the front row, he didn't lead, but he was a very steady finisher, and that was so necessary to the ability to bring one home. On a personal note, and about him, not me, his wife has not been in the best of health for quite a number of years now, and she was, for the last countless years, has been in a wheelchair, and Jimmy doesn't come back anymore. It's been a while since we've seen him, but for many, many years that he would continue to come back here every May and bring her, and he wheeled her everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a prince of a man he was, because not only was he looking after her at home, but he took her to all the events, and if you saw Jimmy McAreath at the track, then there was a wheelchair in front of him, and surely his wife was there. There was tragedy in his life. He had a son, James, who was fatally injured at Winchester in a sprint car after he tried to qualify for the 500 that year. And in fact, golly, can I tell a couple of stories? We may have to take a break here, and I can come back and do.
We have until 9 o'clock.
Oh yeah, I've actually got several McAreath little anecdotes here, but anyway, just to finish on that thought, I just thought what an amazing guy that he was, that he would push his wife around. But I was talking about the fact they lost the son, James. And then also Tony Bettenhausen, young Tony, became like a son to Jimmy. And Tony married one of the McAreath daughters. And then, in fact, when Jimmy drove his next to last 500 in 1979, Tony Bettenhausen was listed as the chief mechanic. And it ended up that they started 35 cars that year, and there was a problem on the pace lap, and Jimmy never took the green flag. And so there was a lot of needling of young Tony Bettenhausen as being the chief mechanic on that car, and it never even got as far as the green. But then years later, of course, Tony Bettenhausen went down in a private plane accident with his wife, who was the McAreath daughter. So they lost a son in racing, and then lost the daughter in the airplane accident. But I maybe could lighten the thing up a little bit. And do I keep going now, or do we need to take a break? Or
we do eventually. How much longer you want to go?
Oh, I don't know. I could three, 4 minutes.
Let's go ahead and step away.
Okay.
And then I've already looked up your, in fact checked you, and you doubt yourself for no reason. 5 wins. You were correct.
Yeah, but I don't know if I could name what all. I got Ontario and Langhorne.
Ontario was the last one. Yeah. Phoenix was one of them. In 65, he won 3 races. He won Trenton, Langhorne, and Langhorne again.
Both Langhorns. And yeah. So that was the first 2 races on pavement. Boy,
And he had a couple of seconds that year. He finished 3rd in points a couple times.
Oh, I should have mentioned that. Yeah. In fact, he was... He was 3rd in points in 65 and 2nd behind Mario Andretti in points in 66.
Okay, and a couple of stories on Jim McAreath as we continue. And then more phone calls on the way. We've got one. What's the over-under tonight on the pace we're at for phone calls?
Oh, I haven't been counting. I think we got 3 on the first night, I think. And
So over-under is generally 4. So
okay.
I know people are wagering on that as well.
Oh, really?
Who's going to be first.
Well.
But everyone's fine with it.
Okay.
They just want to hear you talk. They don't care how many phone calls or questions there are. They just want you to tell stories.
Right,
and that
then.
Will continue in a moment here on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. More of your calls for Donald are coming up when someone hangs up. You can try to call in and maybe get in line for tomorrow night. We're continuing to talk about Jim McElreath.
This is a personal story about me, and then the other one is about him.
We enjoy those, too.
All right. Okay. Anyway, so I know I've been talking a lot about Rushville recently, but I had so much fun going down there year after year. And in 1979, I went down to the Rushville race night at the Knights of Columbus, and I took Jim McElreath with me. And I had a 67 Plymouth Fury, which I'd bought new, but it was now 12 years old. And so anyway, each time when I would meet the driver, I would do this show, which ended at 7 then, and then I'd meet the driver, and then we'd drive on down to Rushville. And so I would always give the driver the opportunity to drive, and many of them would decline, including McElreath. I drove him down and drove him back. And so I was, a little intimidated and thought, I've got to do my very best here because I really didn't know him that well. So I would take the scenic route. We would go down past the Speedrome and then, down 52 to eventually arrive at Rushville. And so I'm trying to be as steady as I can, and I was hearing squealing in the brakes. And so you go through, 10, 12, 15 little places on the way down there. And I was trying to be as easy as I could. He never said a thing. And, the light would change or there would be a stoplight. So I'd back way off and then I'd just get on the brakes very, very gently. And you'd go squeal, And I was so embarrassed. So after this had happened several times, he still hadn't said a thing. I said, I better get her a brake job. And he looked straight ahead and he said, sounds like metal on metal to me. And that's the only thing he said. Anyway, the other one, and I've told this one on the air a few times, I think, back in 2 years before that happened, in 77, was the year that James was at the track. And he took the rookie test. This was the first time a father and son were entered for the first 500. It wasn't the Unsers. They were the first to drive against each other in the same race. But Jimmy McElreath and James tried to qualify for the same 500. So Jimmy was driving for Carrillo, and James was driving for a car that Jimmy owned. And so on the final day, Salt Walther had been bumped. This was the thing. Salt Walther had been bumped, and he had another car ready to go, and it was in line, and it's coming down close to 6 o'clock, and 20 to 6 or 5:45 or whatever it was. James goes out to make a qualifying run, and in those days it's still 3 warm-up laps. So he takes the 3 warm-up laps, takes the green, and then the first lap is not fast enough, but Jimmy lets him stay out there. And eventually runs through the full run and then comes in, which was perfectly entitled to do. And did the four-lap run, was like probably 1.5 miles, 2 miles an hour too slow to make it. And then I don't remember if somebody else may have got out, but the gun goes off and Salt Walther stuck in line with the backup on the outside looking in. And so a lot of the crowd didn't care for that too much. I do remember there was not really loud booing, but there was sort of some people were disgruntled that why don't you bring him in because he's not going to make it and somebody else can go. But Jimmy was perfectly entitled to do it. So probably, half hour, 45 minutes after the track was closed, Ray Marquette, who was a sports reporter for the Indianapolis Star, he said, well, Jimmy, a lot of people are asking why you left him out there. And he said, we'd gone through the whole month. And he said, we knew we were down on speed a little bit and he probably wasn't going to make it. But he said, we're going to come back next year with a much better car. And we thought it would be a great opportunity for James to go through the whole process and feel what it's like to get the instructions and then go out and then take the warm-ups and the green and then just know what you're out there doing for as perfect laps as you can. And he said, so we just thought it would be an experience. So Marquette says, Well, there's a rumor going around that when you drove for the Walther family at Pocono 2-3 years ago, and there was some misunderstanding over the hotel bill, and that you ended up having to pay the hotel bill, and that this was a payback. And Jimmy says, "Oh no, 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 no! We just wanted James to get the experience." So, anyway. They go in opposite directions, and then Marquette turns around and says, "Hey, Jimmy, how much was the bill?" And Macquarie says, $437.18 or something like that. Yeah. But anyway, so we better get back to the phones here.
That was a good story, though. Yeah. That's well thank played. You. That's good. Well played. All right, thank you for the question tonight to get us started. And Michael in Indianapolis is next with Donald Davidson. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hey, Donald. Hey, Kevin. How you guys doing tonight?
Good, thank you.
Hey, I know I haven't done this before with you, Donald, but can you, you might have done with other callers, but can you give me insight what got the Grant and Telly brothers to Indianapolis?
I didn't hear the last part of the question.
What got the Grant and Telly brothers to Indianapolis? What got them interested in getting to the IMS?
What got the Granatelli
what
brothers?
What got the Granatelli brothers interested?
Yeah, what got them interested in Indianapolis? How did they get their start to eventually field cars?
Well, they entered the first race after the after the war in 1946. I think Andy even came as a spectator before the war, and they were from Chicago. I think Andy was born in Texas, but effectively they were raised in Chicago, and they had a business called Granker Automotive Specialists, and Granker was Granatelli Corporation. But basically, it was a hot rod shop, and so Andy just knew about the Indianapolis 500. Why would he get interested in that? Just the same as everybody else would. So I don't think there's any particular story there.
He tried to drive.
Yes, he did.
He was a driver, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. With all of the stories, and some of them kind of grew legs, speeds, as reported by him, tended to be probably a little faster than they were.
Good storyteller.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But in 1948, they ran a car in 46 and 47. Actually, they had two cars in 47. But in 48, with four cars, and he decided to drive one himself. And you read the book, and he's deceased now, bless his heart. I mean, he's breaking the track record every time he went out and was the most popular driver at the track, and the crowd were yelling, "Andy, Andy." Well, not really, but that's his that's his version. But anyway, he did make a qualifying run on the last day, and he was running fast enough to make it by like a half a mile in hand or so. And I think he said he was running 127 miles an hour, I don't remember what it was now, but I read all the reports on it out of the newspaper, and he had three laps that would have been fast enough to squeeze in at the back, and then on the final lap the tire blew and he hit the wall, so you read his book and the description, it's the most horrendous single car accident in the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He did get, he did hit the wall. He did go to the hospital, but he was pretty soon back. And several people told me at the time that, number one, apparently they didn't change the tires. He went out to make a run late on the final day and with tires that they'd been running for quite some time. So instead of putting a fresh or fresher set on, several people. I remember Henry Banks told me. He said what he was doing. He said it was a front drive car and he was pinching it in the turns, and he said that it was pushing so much that he was wearing the rubber off, and so it caused the tire to blow, and he hit the wall. But but for that, the ifs and buts of motor racing, but for that, he would have qualified for the 1948 Indianapolis 500. That's the last time he tried to drive at the Speedway. He did drive stock cars a little bit. In fact, somebody asked about stock cars last year. AAA, the first year that they had a stock car division, Andy was third.
Really?
in a race at Milwaukee I think it would have been a 100-miler when Milwaukee was still dirt, and he was 10th in the 1950 AAA stock car standings. But he was, you know, one of the great promoters of all time. But back to the original question, what got them interested? Who knows? I mean, just why would anybody get interested in it? You hear about it when you're a kid, and he aspired to drive very early on, and I know he wanted to drive the Novi. That when he actually purchased the Novis from Lou Walsh in 1961, I actually found a photograph of him. He was so appreciative. He loved photographs, so appreciative of photographs. And I found one what I thought he may not have seen, and it was probably, I think it was a 1948 shot. And so it's either Duke Nalen or Ralph Hepburn or something sitting in the Novi. And here's Andy, a very, very young Andy, sitting on the wall, staring intently at the car. And when I sent it to him, he said, yeah. He said, I was thinking I'd like to drive that. And I thought, I can see it in your face. It's in the eyes. So anyway, just a great promoter, one of the great characters in the history of the place.
Thank you, Michael. More questions for Donald coming up. The talk of Gasoline Alley. It's race month in May, and this is 107.5 1070 The Fan. Donald Davidson is here addressing the history of the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and I think this is the first time this month we have heard from Jerry in Delphi.
Oh, Jerry, how are you?
Hi, Donald. Hi, Kevin. How are you doing?
Good. I've talked to Jerry on the phone a few times, but not over the air.
No. I'm just going to report on Dave from Marion. I think he probably laid the phone down and forgot where he put it. So
that's all right.
So I'll dig at him a little bit. He's got his birthday coming up next week anyway.
I knew that was coming up pretty soon. I never remember the date, but I know that you always remind us. So anyway, what would you like to hear about?
Could you use a profile of a guy, a driver there, no longer with us, by the name of Sammy Sessions?
Oh, what a great guy he was. He was from Nashville, Michigan, and his name actually, I don't know where the name Sam came from, because his name was Alan Dale Sessions. And so anyway, somebody started calling him Sudden Sam. I don't know what that referred to, but then just caught on and became Sammy. Anyway, he was a modified, super modified driver from Michigan, and ended up running in USAC sprints, and was very successful there. In fact, he was runner up in 1967. Boy, I'm going to have to brush up on this. Greg Weld was the 67 champ, and I think Sam Sessions finished second. I think I've got that right. Anyway, at the Indianapolis Speedway, he was there in 1966, actually. Made a qualifying attempt with the Federal Engineering Detroit Special. In fact, maybe a couple of attempts, but he ended up not completing a run and didn't make the show. In 1967, he was in a car that I really wanted to see make it, because it was front-engined. It was a Mickey Thompson car called the Mickey Thompson's Wind Spitfire Special. I love that name. And it looked like a dragster with engine in the front and injector pipe sticking out of the thing. And I looked like a slingshot dragster. It never made a qualifying attempt. So that was Sam's right. He was in some other stuff as well. But anyway, 68. He jumped around a little bit, but he made the race for Tassie Vattis with one of the Valvoline Specials, and he was Wally Dallenbach's teammate, and he finished ninth as a rookie, and then the next year he drove for Tassie Vattis again and finished 12th. I'm just doing Indianapolis Speedway only here. Although, boy, some of the funniest quotes ever were his. And then in 1970, he drove for one of the Jim Robbins cars, started last and finished 12th. So he'd finished 9th, 12th, and 12th. And then in 1971, he did not finish. He drove J.C. Agajanian and Leonard Farce had teamed up for a team, and they had one of the Colts from the year before, P.J. Colt, one of the Johnny Lightning specials. Either Al Unser's or Joe Leonard's was a hand-me-down, and Sam drove that and dropped out and finished 27th. All right, 1972, he had by far his best finish, and that was fourth. And I do have several Sam Sessions anecdotes, but I'll just do one short one here. 73, he drove for Smokey Yunick with an Eagle with a Chevy with twin turbochargers, and no, he did not. That was in 74 when he didn't qualify. God, I'm going to brush up on this stuff. He drove for MVS in 1973. Then in 74, he was in the Smokey Yunick twin turbocharger job, which ended up when qualifications ended. And that's a whole story there, whether they should or shouldn't have. They did, and he was the first. He was the next one up, so never made a run. And then in 75, he drove for a car that Mike Devon had ended up being a reluctant car owner, and the Commander Motorhome Special. And Sam dropped out of that one, but he actually was running like fifth or sixth when he dropped out. But anyway, he was fatally injured in 1977 on a snowmobile. He was a Arctic Cat, I think, was the team, and he was a factory rider. Anyway, he was a factory rider and lost his life in the snowmobile. But anyway, a sad end there. Great guy, and golly, he well, I need to come back the next night and follow up, because I'm driving home and I'm thinking of all the things that I should have said on these. I'm never happy with my answers, but
here's what we'll do. We'll set you up with a recorder, and then you can start your own podcast.
All right.
So
well,
you can post an addendum to the show every night.
Well, anyway, yeah. I will wind up with this. In 1972, when he got the fourth, it was a really colorful team, Gene White's Firestone team, and there's three drivers. Okay, you ready for this? Lloyd Ruby, K.O. Yarborough, and Sam Sessions. Now, do you suppose there was some fun in that garage area? Anyway, Ruby had at his disposal a brand new Lola, which I think was the T52, which was not the prettiest car that ever came to the track, and there were a couple of those around. Anyway, Ruby had one of those, but he also had one of the Atlanta cars, which was basically a McLaren copy. A number of ex-McLaren people had gone and formed their own team, and they built the cars in Atlanta and called them Atlantas. And so Ruby had one of each. And then the deal was that Sam Sessions was the third man on the totem pole, so he would get whatever's left. And so Ruby decided to go with the Atlanta, and Sessions drove the Lola that nobody really wanted. So K.O. Yarborough finished 10th. Ruby was 6th with the Atlanta, and Sessions was 4th with the Lola. And so he came in the USAC office a couple of days later, and we said, oh, congratulations, that's great. You know, in fact, he had won the sprint car championship in, oh, golly, this is awful. Anyway, he did win the sprint car championship, but he hadn't won it yet, I think. So anyway, so he's got 4th in the Indianapolis 500. This is great. A USAC oval track guy, and, you know, in with all the road races and everything, he gets 4th. So he said, back in the garage, and he says, Ruby came up and said, drove a hell of a race. But he said, I tell you what, son, you just drove yourself out of a race car. And Ruby took the loader to run it at Milwaukee.
Thank you for the question. Good to hear from you, Jerry. More coming up for Donald Davidson, the talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Back to the phones on the talk of Gasoline Alley for Donald Davidson. It's Paul in Racine. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Hi, Paul.
Kevin.
Hi.
Hi, Donald. Wonderful to hear Jerry.
Yeah, he's fine. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's like the crescendo is building for Dave from Marion. So I can't wait for tomorrow.
Yeah, okay. What'd you like to hear about?
Well, I was on track for him, and somebody mentioned the last row party, and you know, I wanted to kind of tap you a little bit about that, and
sure, okay,
ask you, you know, kind of the history of that and how it got started. And I gotta believe 78 was probably, you know, they always talk about the greatest front rows ever. I would think that 78 might be the greatest last row ever, because I believe it contained Mario Andretti and maybe Larry Rice, and I know it contained Mario.
Well, I'd have to. I'm a little hazy on my back rows now. I know Mario was on the back row in 81 and 80. I know that 80 was an exceptional one, because the back row, all three of the cars finished in the top 10, including Tom Sneaver, who finished second, Gary Bettenhausen, who finished third, and Tom Bigelow, who finished eighth, all started on the last row. I don't know what would be the greatest last row ever, but I just throw in that I have a hard time thinking and talking at the same time, and I have to, you know, catch my thoughts while the commercial break was on. I did look this up, but Sam Sessions did win the sprint championship in 72. It was after that fourth place. And just another a little quickie, if I could squeeze this on Sam Sessions, a little bit of useless trivia. It was in 72, I think, that he drove for Foyt at Pocono. He never drove for Foyt at the Speedway, but he did drive at Pocono. And he crashed and hit the wall, and it was because he'd run over a beer can. It was a Budweiser can. And I'm not a great collector of memorabilia, but I have that beer can crushed. Anyway, so last rows. The last row party, I want to say that the first one was 1975. It might have been a little bit before that. I know it was going in 76, because David Hobbs was on the last row, and he said some bad words at the it was a lot of fun. It was started by the Press Club, and I think Art Harris, Gary LaFollette, and there's somebody else that I'm missing. There were three of them, and it was the old Press Club, I don't know when the T-shirts came in, but I think maybe right off the bat, and the prizes were, there was a check, and I think this went back to the very first year, 31st, 32nd, and 33rd, there were checks in the amount of 31 cents, 32 cents, and 33 cents, and I know several drivers have theirs, like Steve Chassie was on the last row, and he kept his check. In fact, I think everybody did. And the trivia that some of them talk about, the fact that there was one driver that actually cashed his check, and that was John Mailer. I don't recall the year. But anyway, they would do the it must have been Gary Varvel, I guess, that did the cartoons every year with the Star, and is still with the Star. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe from the very beginning he did the he did the caricatures for the T-shirts, which they sold, which may go back to the very beginning. But I remember that the thing got bigger and bigger, and at some point Robin got into it. Robin Miller was the compere,
yeah.
And he was lethal, and it was funny. And I remember somebody suggesting, when it had got quite large, they said, "Oh, this is terrific. This should be on TV." And I thought, no, because it was so in, and it was no holds barred. And what was really neat was the people that you would think would not want to go to it would go. And I remember when Cheever was on there. Cheever in 1993, driving for John Menard, was on the last row. And Robin just was skewering him, but trying to be careful. Mario would go. I'm not aware. It must have happened, but I'm not aware of anybody that didn't go back in those days. And when I just had a thought that Oh, I know. Randy Lewis was on the last row, and I remember that Robin had been on Randy Lewis quite a bit, and so Robin was sort of on his best behavior when Randy Lewis came up, and he was a terrific sport. And another thing about whatever people may have thought about Robin in those days, he was so quick. And his material was so good and so biting, because instead of going and getting the joke book and just taking a bunch of jokes and applying it to the people, whether it applied or not, he would actually zap them about stuff that had happened during the month and decisions that were made. And I would think, well, this guy has prepared for all of this. But if somebody would come back and throw a one-liner to him, he would always top him. Mm-hmm. It's just an amazing mind. So whoever it was that would try to fence with him.
That was not a good idea.
It was not a good idea, because Robin would top you. And then it changed direction. And then Dave the King Wilson did it for a while. And then Bob Jenkins did it. And I think they still have it. But I went the year that Jean Lalisse was on the back row, and I was invited to stop by, and it was a considerably more polite than it was back in the heyday when Robin was the host.
It takes a special person to lead a roast.
Oh yes,
and it's someone like Robin that can do that and still be friends with that person. I'm not willing to do that.
No,
I have no interest in leading that kind of a charge.
I agree. That is a totally different subject. But Tom Carnegie was terrific at, if you like, insult humor, Rickles-type humor. And I know other people have tried it, and some well-known names have tried it, and it really doesn't work out.
You got to be quick.
You got to be really quick. And a couple of times I've been invited to be on a roasting panel, and a couple of times I did it, and other times I declined because I thought, no, because it's a special kind of humor. And if you're really biting, I mean, somebody can be hurt by it.
Exactly.
And I don't want to do that.
So you mentioned Hobbo, and I have had the pleasure of spending a few evenings with David Hobbs. And mm-hmm. you reminded me of this.
Mm-hmm.
One, did he tell the 20 quid story? And two, as a Brit, are you familiar with this story? It's one of Hobbo's famous stories, 20 quid. Have you heard of this?
No.
We won't be telling it on the show. We can't do that.
All right, then, okay. I can tell you.
It's really good, and I wondered how long has he been telling this story, because it's one of the David Hobbs staples
in
private conversation with people that we're all familiar with.
All right. I may recognize it as soon as you start, but I can tell you that when he made the last row in 1976, he was driving for the Walthers, and leave it up to your imagination, some of the things that were said that night. So you tell me the 20 quid story when we're off the air.
Okay, And by the way, while Donald doesn't look things up, I do. And the 1978 last row, Mario was in the last row because of the first weekend rained out, and then he had to go to Formula One. So Mike Hiss
qualified the car.
Qualified the car mm-hmm. for him. Yeah. The rest of the last row was, I had it here, it was Gary Bettenhausen and Jerry Sneva. And Larry Rice was the outside of row 10. So he was very close to being back there as well. So the point was taken that you had some pretty strong competition coming from the back that year.
Fittipaldi was on the last row one time, and I'm assuming that he went. As I say, I was never aware of a driver that did not go.
Thank you for the call tonight, Paul. We'll give it a go. I've got about a minute left.
Oh.
So we may make this a two-parter through tomorrow, unless it's a simple question, Andy. But you've hung on a long time, so hello, Andy.
Thanks, guys. It's an absolute honor to talk to you. I will try to make this quick. I graduated high school in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, which is about 20 miles away from Eau Claire. So there is obviously one guy that everybody knows about from Eau Claire, which is John Menard. I came to realize a while back that there's another guy that most people, including myself, don't know much about, Herm Johnson. Would you be able to talk about him some?
Yes, I will, but I'll do. You give me the countdown, Kevin. Or
basically, we need to save this for tomorrow night.
Yeah, all right.
You can't do this in 30 seconds.
All right, so I will lead off with Herm Johnson tomorrow night.
Okay, thank you, Andy. So that will kick us off tomorrow night, and then Dave from Marion is welcome to be caller number one and topic number two if he calls us at 10 till tomorrow night. No one else try to sneak in, because we'll recognize Dave from Marion's voice. And if you say you're Dave from Marion and you're not, Joey may not, but we're not answering your question. And we're not answering your question. So that'll be tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And we'll have our view staring into the sun at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And that's a good thing,
right,
because the weather is supposed to be perfect tomorrow and Saturday. See you tomorrow night, Donald.
All right,
thanks,
Kevin.
Thanks to Joey Molinaro. I'm Kevin Lee. Podcast will be up in a few minutes via iTunes and at 1070thefan.com.